At AVNR, our mission is to humanize robotics. We decided to create this podcast series to help you demystify the world of robotics and discover what some of the brightest minds in the field are doing. Welcome to Robotics for All Podcasts by AVNR.
In this episode, we're excited to welcome Ben Williams, the Chief Operating Officer of XN Technologies. Besides acting as COO for XN, Ben is an active mentor for early stage startups and entrepreneurs. He consults and speaks throughout the New York and Philadelphia startup scenes. At XN, they are an autonomous robotics company pioneering GPS-denied and infrastructureless autonomy for robots performing a variety of tasks. Ben walks us through why this is such a big deal for some of the more hazardous industries such as mining and construction. The drones and robots that Ben's teams deploys are out in the field finding their own way around, getting some dangerous work done. Tune in for an enlightening conversation on the cutting edge of technology and the future of autonomous robotics. Hope everyone enjoys the show. Here we go.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Great. First, Ben, let's start off. Tell me a little bit about yourself and XN Technologies.
Sure. So XN Technologies is an autonomous robotics company. We focus on the intersection of high accuracy rapid mapping and autonomous navigation for small scale robotic systems. And we're based in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, venture backed company, a spin out of the University of Pennsylvania. I personally am the chief operating officer here and have been here for about 5 years. Broadly, my charter is productization, execution, and go-to-market. You can think of it as taking the core technologies and bringing them to bear in a product and customer-oriented setting.
Okay, great. So you said something there that piqued my interest. You said small-scale robotic systems. Mm-hmm. So when I think about a drone and the amount of area it can cover compared to what we do, that feels a little bit larger scale. So explain to me what your definition of small scale is.
Yeah, it probably depends on the audience, right? Yeah, so in this case, what I mean by small scale robotic systems are systems that are smaller than a vehicle that could carry people. So this is mostly things that are quadruped robots like a Boston Dynamics Spot or Ghost Robotics, et cetera, or quadcopters, drones that are probably something you could carry as a person, but that could not in fact carry a person. But it's also not so small that it's, going through, a 1 centimeter square, or it's not something that's, going in your bloodstream or something. It's, I guess, in the grand scheme of things, it's a mid-scale robot.
Okay. So you're not talking about the amount of area you're covering, but the size of the robot itself.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what type of payloads do you typically get into with your solutions?
So system that goes on a lot of different kinds of things. We can be guiding any type of system, and therefore all kinds of different payloads can go on top of it. Core to the baseline approach is that we do sensor fusion of a lot of different things. So we can roll in the core geometric models that are captured by the mapping. You can also overlay that with visual or infrared photography or video. You can integrate things like RFID for logistics. You can do gas sensing, radiation sensing, temperature sensing. You can get this really rich data set covering an environment, which is the whole purpose of these systems in a lot of cases, is to do more faster and easier than a person could carrying a bunch of devices and trying to measure things.
Sure. And I, as I was going through your website, you talked a lot about mining. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing that's a pretty dangerous. There was one really interesting article, and I'm jumping in our list of topics here, but there's one interesting article about you guys were brought in to look at some historical mines. Mm-hmm. And so what was the purpose of that? Like, what was the company trying to achieve by looking at some of these old mines? Is it from just a curiosity standpoint, or what was going on?
Yeah. So in a lot of those cases, mines that haven't been worked in a long time, may have been shut down for economic reasons or safety reasons or, 100 different things. But they often look at reopening them in the future. And to reopen them, if they haven't been operating in a while, they haven't been checked or, verified safe, There's a lot of work to go through to explore the mine, map it, figure out what you have to do to update the safety structure. You know, is it even possible or economical to do it? And so in a lot of those cases where you're investigating old workings or old mines, you need to basically put a system in there before a person goes in, and you don't know what the environment is going to look like. So you might just set an explore volume and say, look, just find whatever you can in there. Give me the best model and any visual visual insight you can as well. And that can be the baseline for them going in and setting up, you know, safe entry and inspection and begin planning for whatever it is they want to do with it, whether it's to reopen it as a mine or open it as a tourist attraction or use it for some other industrial purpose like storage. There's a lot of reasons to reopen some of those facilities.
Right. And I'm imagining, you know, inside a mine, there's not many external information you get to go off of, right? So years ago, I used to go to a vision conference in Boston, and there was a working group where you would tell all stories about your worst machine vision implementations, you know, your best fails.
Yeah.
And back then, one of the conversations switched over to a DARPA challenge, where some guys were trying to figure out how to map mines with no GPS signal data.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of your claims to fame was GPS denied environments.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you guys figured it out. I, back then I was thinking, well, that's a dream, you know, that's a tough problem to solve. So how did you get into that kind of niche and maybe explain what is a GPS denied environment and why it's important?
Absolutely. So we got our start doing that because we were building an odometry-based system. And odometry is basically a way of calculating a position in an environment, or what's called localization. And it basically is tracking features in the environment using a sensor. When those features move, if they all move kind of at the same time, then the system guesses, I must be moving because all the features around me are moving. And what that does for you is that it gives you a sense for where you are on a local frame, you know, relative to where you just were. It tells you like small changes in movement, which is not the same as GPS, because that gives you a global frame of reference, like where am I in the world as well as where am I moving locally. But it's a starting point. And so using this sort of core technology, you can actually start to establish where you are moving over a slightly larger area. And that in turn means that you can navigate in these local environments without the need for a GPS or equivalent. And so we first started applying this to commercial mining, because those are underground and you don't get GPS at all in most of those environments. And so that was a critical need they had, and they drew us in, basically said, look, it seems like you can solve this. Let's get moving. And we have our first partnerships there began 5 years ago. And we've been operating autonomously and in GPS denied for all of that time. And, you know, GPS denied in those environments is really obvious, because you can't have it at all. You don't start with it. You don't end with it. You never have it. Where it gets really interesting is in places where you might have it sometimes, but you can't necessarily count on it. So think of, you know, if you're flying outside or driving outside, you mostly have GPS. But if you are going next to a lot of tall buildings or underneath a large bridge or in a parking garage, you might lose GPS, you know, here and there throughout it. And so what that means is that if you're depending on GPS, you might be stuck, or you might not be able to tell where you're going while you have lost signal. So having a system that is resilient to the loss of GPS is a little bit different than totally GPS denied, but still really important. And especially for an autonomous system where there's no human in the loop there to say, well, I still know where I'm going because I can look around and see. I don't need the GPS every second. In this case, you have to have a system that is resilient to the loss of signal so that it can continue navigating, continue performing its mission, so that eventually when it gets GPS back, it can relocalize on the global frame of reference, but it's still able to navigate and perform its mission in the interim.
Right. So a lot of these missions you're doing are gathering data of, let's say, unexplored environments. Mm-hmm. So what are the parameters? I'm imagining, so you know you're an environment and you say, okay, I want you to go here, then here, mm-hmm. and you set up a route, and maybe there's some things it does in between. in your case, when you don't know very much about the environment,
right,
you just set this your drone loose and it goes for a certain period of time. Walk us through how that
works. I think that is probably the most interesting and unique thing about our system. And you know, the autonomy industry in general is trying to get to these kind of levels, which is being able to remove specific path planning or specific mission planning from the humans table and instead having the robot do it. And so you instead, as a human, say, I just want to do this high level objective, which is explore this building or explore this area underground that may or may not have a cave or a mine or a tunnel. If there is, explore it. If there's not, then just come back home. And so creating a high level objective, and then the system self-defines safe navigation corridors, intermediate objectives and milestones and sort of success criteria along the way, that creates a wholly different type of mission planning, which means that you don't have to do it as a human, and it can react and respond to changes or new information in that environment all along the way, which is, you know, that's the target for an autonomous system. And it's a great sequence for us.
Right. So there's six levels of autonomy that kind of have been sketched out. Where do you guys fit yourself into the level of autonomy that you can achieve?
So it seems like every company sort of comes up with their own. We've tried to standardize as much as we could. We went off of the SAE standards for self-driving cars. We worked with IEEE and some universities to try and have sort of a vetted standard for us. So with that in context, we have an article published a couple years ago that gives more detail, but the short version is we sit at what we call level 4 autonomy. And level 4, in this case, we are defining as able to execute a high-level mission objective without interaction from a person to kind of interpret pieces along the way. And so what that practically means from our perspective is that the system is self-contained. And once you give it the mission objective, you can actually turn off your tablet, you can turn off the radio, and the system will complete its own mission without any input or, you know, changes in parameters from the tablet, which in the drone world is called a ground control station. But the whole idea is that you're sort of decoupling that a little bit, and that system is self-operating, and you are breaking that link between single operator and single drone as kind of a required linkage.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Now, do you think this is a tougher solution space than, let's say, self-driving cars when you're dealing with drones, or would you say that cars are a tougher solution space for autonomy?
You probably get in endless arguments about this.
Yeah.
There's things that are easier and then things that are harder. On the thing that's easier about cars is that you are generally in a structured environment. You can usually make some assumptions that you'll probably have GPS. You're probably going to have lines on the road. There are mostly what you're worrying about are people or bikes or cars or trucks. And there's, you know, you can do some classification and machine learning stuff that give you a leg up there. That also operates at a much faster speed. So you need, you know, highway speeds, you need better, faster processing than you do for, you know, a slower moving robot. You also need to be able to respond at very high speed when someone is coming at you. So there might be a differential speed of, you know, 120 miles an hour plus. So there's issues to work through there as well. For the aerial robotics side, you know, you can't depend on having an accurate map. You can't depend on any kind of rule set. There could be things coming from 360 degrees and up and down and, you know, every direction. And so you need a broader sort of sensing, but you also have freedom to move in three dimensions, which you don't on a car on a road. You have, you know, two dimensions only. So there's other interesting things. It's like a different way of thinking about the autonomy. And we specifically work in unstructured environments where you're working at slower speed, but it's much more complex. And so you need to be calculating and recalculating safe navigation corridors continuously, and you don't necessarily know what's around the next corner, and you don't have a pre-made map in a lot of cases. So it's a different beast. I think you could probably argue either one is harder, but probably the folks that know them best would say that the one that they work on is the hardest.
Of course. Now, what are typical speeds that your robots work at?
It depends. For some of the mining world, we artificially restrict the speed because you don't need to do really big captures. And a lot of the end customers prefer denser data sets. So flying slower gives you more information. So we artificially cap it at 2 meters per second or 2.5 meters per second. We've demonstrated 5, 10, 15 meters per second in different environments. So you can get going pretty fast. But in most of the cases we're looking for, you're not trying to go that fast because you're not trying to cover a huge area. You're trying to get highly dense, accurate information for areas of interest, right? And so those are often places that either people can't get to or are difficult or not economical to get to. And so you are often covering very specific environments with these types of systems.
Right. Now, the one intriguing thing, so everything you're, I'm not in the world of drones and, unplanned missions and stuff like that. Everything we do is pretty planned. But on your website, you've got a number of distributors and partners that are there, using these systems to solve problems. So I find that interesting because, you were able to make this complicated technology at least simple enough that you can have a couple partners, right? Yeah. So what type of skill do you need to operate one of these systems?
So we have purposefully made the system easy enough to operate that anyone that can use a smartphone can basically operate the system. That is not the same thing as saying an expert operator can be someone who has no knowledge about the space. We do oftentimes, 1 or 2 days of training for new operators to teach them all the edge cases and how to, optimize usage. But we've done plenty of demonstrations where we will show people how to plan a mission, hand them the tablet, and within 5 minutes, they've flown their first autonomous mission. And so not super complicated to get started. To become a really, a real power user, takes a little bit of time and experience to learn sort of the edge cases. But the whole point of these systems is to remove the cognitive load from humans and put it onto the robot. And so if it's really complicated to start off with, then we haven't done our job in the first place.
Right. And typically when customers come to you, are they buying a system or are they asking for you guys to help them out map an area or is it a mix of both?
It's definitely a mix. We do sometimes do services work where we'll go and help people, get a specific map if they don't have a use case where they're going to use it regularly. We like to help out where we can. We also have partners that are part-time distributors, part-time services groups, and we try and support them to do a lot of this work as well. Our core is as a product company, so we're not really built around the services model. So we mostly try and build the systems that people can use to support their businesses, whatever that looks like. So we find the systems used quite a bit in services and contract work, as well as internal to companies that have their own operators that are doing the flights or the captures themselves as well.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now we talked about mining. What other industries are big for you guys? What are established ones? And then I'm also curious what emerging industries do you see coming?
Yeah. So, we do a fair amount of work in the government space, mostly around, similar use cases where you're capturing sort of inaccessible data or difficult to access data. You can think onboard ships or critical infrastructure, bases, bridges, tunnels, et cetera. A lot of the stuff that you can think of as being sort of in the combined civil, federal, and DoD space, that kind of broad coverage we do a lot of work in. And then that extends actually into one of our newer markets, which is the sort of the broad survey and geospatial. And this is a little bit different than the geospatial of like pure satellite, where you're very high altitude capturing sort of 2D or 2.5D maps. Instead, this is, think of the, the 5 feet to 50 feet or 5 feet to 500 feet level of three-dimensional data that is, centimeter accuracy, easily updated, rapid capture, where you're then integrating it into these global models. And so there's a ton of interest around infrastructure, especially operations and planning, you know, being able to go and capture the actual as-built environment so that you can then put it into a VR environment or, you know, a game engine, you know, modeling environment where you're able to figure out how much clearance there is underneath a bridge or, you know, for a large truck going around a curve, you know, what is the actual clearance for you in that space, not going off of 50-year-old, you know, construction drawings, but going to seeing what's there today, is a huge benefit operationally. So there's a lot of really interesting use cases that, in a lot of cases wouldn't have been possible 5 years ago, but then you get a mapper in your hand, you can just capture these amazing data sets quickly.
Yeah, and I guess it's the volume of data as opposed to coming out with some of the more manual kind of surveying equipment.
Right.
You get much higher fidelity, I'm imagining.
Well, a lot of times it's about being able to capture it quickly enough and economically enough. Yeah. Like if you have enough guys out there with tripod scanners, you know, you would eventually get the data that you need, but you're gathering it 10 times faster with a mobile mapper or an autonomous system than you are with sort of a stationary system. And some of the stationary systems end up being higher accuracy than we can get because you're sitting in a specific place and there are very high precision lasers. And, you know, there's a category where those are still the gold standard and will be, because we're not trying to tackle, you know, all of those use cases, but especially for places where people are just not even bothering to gather the data because it would take too long or it would cost too much.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden, a single person with one of these systems can go capture all of that data that you need in an afternoon, which otherwise would take a team of five a whole week. And that is an order of magnitude increase in speed and the ability to capture data you probably just wouldn't have bothered with before.
Right. I can see the city of Montreal being interested in counting construction cones. I mean, we always make jokes that as soon as the snow melts, you know, the construction crews come out and they just move cones around until the snow comes back.
Yep.
So, you know, I'm sure there's a good inventory count that they could use help with.
Yep.
So over the next 4 to 5 years, what do you see as important for your industry? If there was some breakthroughs, what are the big challenges that you guys have of being able to unlock some challenging applications?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the hardest work that's going to come over the next few years is going to be the least sexy, and it's going to be under the hood stuff where, you know, there's been a ton of advancement in new capabilities and new features and functionality. And oftentimes when you have an industry come out with a bunch of crazy new features, they'll work, you know, with some asterisks. It'll work given specific conditions or, you know, a perfect environment or a really capable user. And the work to grow adoption of those technologies is usually, you know, 5 or 10 years of cranking through user experience improvements, edge case coverage, reliability, scalability, and cost. And so we're kind of in the middle of that sequence right now where, you know, we've been spending the last couple of years really focused on just making the core product better and making the systems last longer and, you know, work every time. And so a lot of that work is really what's going to improve the end user experience the most, I think, over the next few years. But what is going to happen, I think, in the next 2 to 3 years is you're going to see much broader adoption of autonomous systems in industrial environments because of that work that's going to make them more reliable. And, you know, people have already seen the flashy side of it. So everyone is kind of interested and they're doing little tests here and there. Yeah. And now we're finally starting to see the light bulbs go off when they've done some testing and they go, oh, you know what? This actually is good enough for us that we're willing to buy 3 more or 5 more or 10 more and start scaling across an enterprise. So I think you're going to see a lot more adoption in this industry in general for these sort of mobile autonomous systems, just digitizing their environments for especially industrial and enterprise clients.
Will be a more common tool in the toolbox, another Milwaukee tool that that you see on the job site.
Yep.
Yeah. One of the applications that captured my imagination when one of the latest rovers went onto Mars and it had a drone on it.
Yeah.
And they started, you know, flying mini missions to on Mars itself. And I that was
it's amazing.
You know, I had never thought about it.
Yeah.
You know, but a lot of smarter, much smarter people did, and they made it happen, right? What are some of the most interesting applications that you see out there that if you had more time, you know, we have to focus on, you know, what pays the bills and what people need right now, but what are some of the more interesting or exotic applications you've seen out there?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many really interesting ones actually happening now because of the, you know, the cost curve is coming down and the capability curve is going up, and you're getting a lot of interesting new crossovers for applicability. So I think there's going to be some fascinating stuff happening with fully unmanned industrial zones where there are, you know, an underground mine where there are no people underground. There's a construction site where there are no people in a whole section of it. There's going to be, you know, foundries or factories or, you know, fill in the blank warehouses that people have been removed from entirely. Or there's, you know, there's the most dangerous zones are going to be completely sealed off from people. The inside of nuclear plants, those kind of, like, there's all kinds of options and opportunities where, you know, people don't really want to be in the most dangerous environments anyway. A lot of those industries are having trouble staffing those jobs. And so they can't even operate without getting robots involved in the first place. So it ends up being this massive productivity boost. So, you know, then that extends into space travel work. That's always been the place where unmanned has the most, you know, opportunistic place, because when you have an unmanned system in space, you don't need to think about oxygen or safety systems or, you know, any of the food or waste or whatever. Your efficiency goes way, way up. So, you know, think of automated docking systems, you know, unmanned mining on asteroids. You know, there's all this crazy stuff that you can start getting into now that you have systems that are able to stand on their own and be fully autonomous.
Right. Oh, that's really interesting. So in an industrial environment where, you know, let's say it's an unmanned underground mine, what type of safety requirements are put around or your drone? Is it, you know, is the order of priority that, you know, for a robotic system in a manufacturing environment, you know, the people around the system come first, right? And then you put all the safeguards in to make sure they can't put their hand in, the robot can't get its arm out and stuff like that. And everything revolves around that.
Right.
What's your order of priorities when looking in an industrial setting?
I mean, I think it's the same, right? Those priorities are consistent across any of the industrial customers. So especially, you know, we're working, not predominantly, but we're working in significant volume in Western Europe and Northern Europe and US, Canada, Mexico, et cetera. So, you know, those are places with pretty strict rules and regulations around safety and industrial policy. And so those are how we design the system anyway, no matter where it is in the world. And so it's designed specifically with safety in mind. We have, you know, safety boundaries around the system so that it doesn't get too close to people or walls or wires or any of these things. And, you know, that's something that you can adjust if you really want to, but we ship it with a pretty conservative approach towards safety, because, you know, as you say, the priority is people first. And, you know, once you get people comfortable with the usability and how it can help them, then they start using it more. So it's a self-reinforcing thing as well. You know, it gets them to use it more.
So are you guys detecting the types of objects that are in the environment? If a person walks in, are you looking for if there's a person in the environment?
We've done some integrations like that where you do sort of people classification and you can sort of take action on it. But mostly we do environmental classification where you're understanding elements in the environment and what that means to safety of flight. So, you know, removing yourself from dust or fog or, you know, rapid temperature transients, you want to get out of that zone because it can mean something for safety of flight. So there's a lot of these little edge cases that are basically environmental impacts that you want the system to identify, classify, and then take action on, regardless of whether there's a human in the loop or not. And so that's been a bigger portion of our focus. Most of the environments we operate in, there are people present, but you try not to operate where people are, like, right next to robotic systems most of the time.
Right. So any dangerous area that, or a GPS denied area that people need some data of, maybe they want to do with something in that environment, change the environment, but that's where you guys fit in very well.
That's right.
Am I capturing that right?
Yeah, no, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah. Okay. Now, besides, you know, making sure drones know where they're going and you know, getting big amounts of data from these environments, what do you like to do in your spare time?
Well, I've got a 3 and a 5 year old, so my time is mostly spent keeping them from smashing dishes on the floor and pouring yogurt and behind the couch and all that kind of stuff. But beyond that, I used to do a lot of mountaineering, and I played rugby for a long time. It was really fun. I do a lot of active mentorship as well for the startup community in New York and Philadelphia. So that's pretty much how I spend my time, I think.
Okay, great. Well, Ben, it's been really fascinating to hear about XN Technologies and what you guys are up to. Any last things that you'd like to mention?
No, I appreciate you having me on the podcast here. It's been really fun.
Yeah, it'd be great to have you back in a little while to hear what's new with you guys and hear if you got into some really fascinating applications.
Absolutely. We got a lot of good stuff coming up. We'll have to get back on soon.
Right on. Appreciate it, Ben.
Absolutely.
So this concludes the episode of Robotics for All podcast by AVNR. If you don't want to miss another single episode, don't forget to subscribe to our show in your favorite podcast app. Thank you very much, everyone. And we'll talk again soon.